Hello, everybody! You are listening to Limited Playtime, the board game podcast where we bring you board game reviews in 30 minutes or less.
Or the next episode is free.
I am Kyle Bolin.
And I'm Jason Cavallari.
And I am Milo Bolin.
That's right. And today we are doing our massive Gen Con extravaganza 2022.
Yeah!
Mostly because we just didn't get around to doing any recordings while we were at Gen Con for some reason.
We were having too much fun.
We were having too much. I was talking to Brian last night about it, and he was like, how did that happen?
How can you have too much fun if you're having so much fun? A lot of fun is a good thing.
That is true. What I told him was, I think the difference between this year and previous years was that we scheduled events very late.
Yeah.
Like, we were getting out at, like, 10 or 11 o'clock on at least, like, two of the three nights, if not... Mm-hmm. I think one night we just skipped some stuff and, like, started our own, like, sort of private gaming around, like, 6 p.m. or something. But I believe that the other, like, two nights that we were there, we had events ending at 11 or 10 o'clock. And so, you know, typically that's, you know, we start recording at, like, 8 o'clock in the evening or something when we do our recordings on site.
Right, yeah.
And back in the room. And we weren't spending nearly as much time in the room, so
yeah.
We just didn't get around to doing it. So tonight,
especially when I was there,
yeah. So tonight we're gonna do it all at once. We're gonna do it live, which is really not live. It's recorded, but it's live to us. So
yeah.
And we're gonna start with Milo because Milo was there on Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon. He got to do two ticketed events and also just, you know, the general walking around the convention center, taking in the milieu of the whole thing.
Playing the video game arcade!
Well, we're going to get to that because that was one of your ticketed events. And we'll talk to him about what was interesting as a seven-year-old who is just having his first Gen Con experiences that he'll remember. And find out how all that went for you, okay? So, Milo, your mom, my wife, my wonderful wife, she was kind enough to come and drop you off on Saturday morning at 8:45 in the morning so that I could get you in line for your vaccination band, which did not really need to happen because there was no line, and we just walked right up and you got your vaccination band.
I think it might have been because I blew on my hand and pretended I was rolling a dice.
You thought you were doing something to give yourself good luck. Yeah. But in fact, I think it was just because everybody that needed a band already had one by that point because it was Saturday morning. It was like the third day of the convention and really like the fourth day that people were there because most people show up on Wednesday. But anyway, so that morning we were waiting for the exhibition hall to open up at 10 a.m. to go look at all the different products so that you could do a little shopping with me.
And while we were doing that, we got two tickets for the video game arcade so we could play there.
That's because we had an hour to kill, right?
Yeah.
Because between 9 and 10 we had nothing to do because we thought we were going to be standing in a line.
Yeah, we didn't even have a knife to kill time.
So I got us two tickets for the Retro Game Arcade, which is the like retro arcade that they set up in one of the rooms directly across from the exhibition hall.
Now, I'm going to say something real quick that could improve it.
Oh, you've got criticisms.
It could be a lot bigger because it's not that big of an arcade.
It wasn't huge,
I've seen some bigger arcades.
That's true. But I mean, I think for a tabletop board gaming convention, they did pretty good, I think. They had some really cool stuff in there, right?
Especially that game you loved.
Queen
Killer!
Killer Queen.
Oh, yeah.
So we played some light gun games. We played some really retro games like Donkey Kong and Burger Time.
I played some racing games. I hated the motorcycle game.
You hated it?
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
I thought that was really cool because you're actually like kind of leaning back and forth or like side to side on the motorcycle.
Yeah, but it was really hard to like control it.
Yeah, but it was really cool still. We messed around a little bit with the multicade.
That bowling ball game was really like bad controls.
Well, you were using a trackball and you've never seen one of those in your life, so that was a new thing for you. But yeah, so I mean, like, eventually we played all those games and eventually we settled on Killer Queen, which is a modern game. It's only a few years old, I think. And it's a 10-person cabinet where there's two teams, two screens, and on either side you've got like up to four drones or workers for a team of like sort of insect type people, and then one person in the very center of that particular console is the queen, and the queen can like attack right off the bat and everything. And there's three ways to win in Killer Queen. You've got your workers who can go and collect berries and then bring them back to your base and try to fill up the base with berries.
You can win with the snail snail, which yeah, I was going for.
That's right. There's like a snail at the bottom of the screen, and one of the workers can try to ride the snail.
Yeah, and I was singing a song while I was riding it.
You were.
It was silly.
Or you can play, if you're the queen, you can try to kill the other queen 3 times. And if you do that, then your side wins. So it was like Milo, myself, and another little girl versus, I think, like maybe, like there was like a grown man and maybe like 2 teens on the other side. So maybe they were her family or something.
It was really fun.
Yeah. And I've played Killer Queen Black before because it was on Game Pass for the Xbox. So I had played that a bit last year, but we came away from that just really wanting to play more, so I've already purchased Killer Queen Black for the PC, so we can continue to play that in the near future. So far, game of the show,
I think
Killer
we're
going to
play with Brian.
Yeah, he said he'd be interested in playing. But after we did that, what did we do?
We went to the Exhibition Hall.
The Exhibition Hall, that's right. And what did we do at the Exhibition Hall?
Look at so many cool things. Like Space Marines.
You got your picture with the giant Space Marine statue, didn't you?
Yeah!
They have like a life-size Space Marine there. He's like 8 feet tall, just like a real Space Marine.
My voice was at zero there.
Yeah, you got loud. All right, so you got your picture taken with a Space Marine. You got to go into the Games Workshop booth and look at all of the Warhammer stuff.
Yeah!
What was that like?
It was super fun!
Yeah? What was the coolest thing you saw in the Warhammer booth?
The Ultramarine mech. It was amazing!
The statue, you mean?
Yeah. No, not.
Oh, the toy! Yeah, they had the Joy Toy Space Marine toys there. So.
So you
saw the Joy Toy toys there, which are like these big, beefy, really high detailed toys that they make.
They looked expensive!
And they were, yeah. You wanted to get this box of 4 Space Marines, and it was $150. So we did not. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A wise decision.
Yeah. I told you could put it on your Christmas list, and we'll see. But I don't know that you'll still be wanting that.
And that was not a trick question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what else did you see on the show floor that you thought was cool?
That thing that we ended up buying a bunch of stuff.
BattleTech?
Yeah!
Yeah, we decided to jump into the BattleTech pool, so we bought a mat. So what did you like about the BattleTech stuff?
It looks super cool.
Yeah, what did we get at the BattleTech store?
You got BattleTech stuff that you already got.
Huh?
You got BattleTech stuff that you already got,
Well,
Dad.
We found out, we realized we found my old BattleTech stuff from the 90s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the figures that we got are way more modern and way more detailed and way cooler.
Yeah.
And we got the book to play and we got a mat to play with as well.
Yes.
So we're going to try that out, right?
Yep.
We got a game for your little brother. You helped me pick out a game for Timmy, right?
Yeah.
What was it called? Do you remember?
I think it was called Animal Friends.
Forest Friends.
Oh.
Do you remember what you do with that game?
You make a little box and guess what animals are inside the box.
Yeah, you like kind of peep through some holes and try to see if you can like identify the animals correctly. It's basically for 2-year-olds and up, right? So you're a little old for it, but it'll be perfect for Timmy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we looked around for something for you, and what did you find? Speak up.
BattleTech!
What else did we find?
Dogman.
Well, we didn't buy Dogman, but you tried the Dogman board game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did it look interesting?
Yes!
Yeah, was it fun?
Yes!
Okay. You tried like 3 different Dogman games. They had like a card game where you try to like eat a hot dog or something. They had one where you're, I don't remember what the other 2 games were. Do you remember what the other 2 games were about?
Ringing the bell.
Oh, there was a bell game, right, where you ring a bell.
And Petey and Dogman.
Were they like little Petey's chasing you or something? I don't remember.
Not little Petey, normal Petey.
Oh, normal Petey, okay. Okay, but then you got a Pokemon, right?
Yeah, it was Blastoise!
Right, okay. Then after that, we went and ate lunch, and then you did your big event, which was Tabletop Escape Room to the Aid of Santa.
We did part one,
yeah.
Let me tell you. It was super tricky.
Tricky?
The funnest part about it was, we did a Mad Lib!
You did do a Mad Lib. Yeah, they had me come in and pretend to be a snowman who you were reading the Mad Lib to.
Yeah!
Yeah. But it was a lot of puzzles, right?
Yeah, like so many locks.
Was it pretty fun and satisfying to get through?
Yes.
Yeah? Do you think you'd do the same thing next year if you get to go back?
Probably part 2.
Yeah?
Because we only did part 1!
Uh-huh.
I'm going to do part 2, too.
Okay.
Wait, I said part 2, too.
You did, yeah. Okay, so overall, what did you think of Gen Con? Did you like seeing all the stuff around, all the people in costumes and everything?
I didn't like it. I loved it!
All right.
I'm definitely going back every single year.
Yeah, we've got a Gen Con convert here. Now worshiping at the altar of the con.
The brainwashing.
Yeah, so as long as they don't leave Indianapolis for some reason, then you will be back, I'm sure, right?
Yeah!
Okay. Anything else you want to say about Gen Con, Milo?
Yeah. Well, when I move out of the house...
Okay.
I'm not going to move very far so I can go to Gen Con every single year in my life.
Okay. So we got to stay in the Indianapolis orbit as long as Gen Con is here, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's also things like... And then I'm going to move closer to Gen Con again.
Okay. Well, okay. If Gen Con leaves, then we'll have to find a new place to live, won't we?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for being here, buddy.
You're welcome.
Okay, why don't you get upstairs so you can start getting ready for bed soon, okay?
And probably do another high-level monster with Mom.
Okay, that sounds fine. Make sure you shut the door behind you, okay?
Okay.
All right. Thanks, buddy.
Bye, Milo.
You're welcome.
It's time for Adult Swim. All the kids out of the pool. All right, that was Milo. But we're really here to talk about everything else now, right?
Right.
Because that's what we know.
We know some things.
I kept a journal that I wrote down every single thing that we played. Not necessarily everything that we saw, because there was a lot of things that we, like, you know, put our eyeballs on, but we didn't actually engage with, so yeah. I didn't write all that down. But I started with Day Zero, which is what we refer to Wednesday as. And while waiting for you at the airport, our friend Gabe, who was there at the Gen Con with us the entire time and was kind enough to take video and even, like, edit some of the video together already, he and I played Mini Rogue while waiting for you. And to bookend the trip just perfectly, you and I played Mini Rogue on the final day.
Yep.
While we were waiting for your flight. So I thought maybe we'd start there and talk about Mini Rogue.
Sure.
It wasn't a game that we bought at the convention. It was a game that I had that I brought with me that I had purchased earlier this year. But it's basically like a small, compact dungeon crawler that is also a roguelike in the sense that you get some gear, you maybe like level up your character a little bit, and you are fragile enough that the run can just end basically at any given time, and then that's it, you're done, right? Like, if you want to play more, you start fresh from the very beginning. There's no save mechanic, there's no, you know, like, second life or anything like that. That's Rogue. So what did you think of that, Jason?
I thought it was a lot of fun, actually. Mm-hmm. I didn't really know what to expect. Like, I'd only ever heard of the game from you, and I was like, well, okay, you know, it's something that we can play in like 40 minutes before I have to go to the, you know, to my gate or whatever.
Yeah.
I was like, sure, let's give it a shot. But it was surprising. It was surprisingly fun. You know, the I like the way that you like have to travel through this dungeon that's made up of the cards. Like, you don't have to stay together as a party. You can split up and go different ways. You know, you can either like maximize exploration or you can go the safe route and just both go the same way. I think the combat system is fun. I mean, it's largely, if not entirely, dice driven, but at the same time doesn't seem like terribly, terribly difficult. It just sort of is a fun little, you know, truck the dice and see where they land and, you know, hopefully you'll come out okay kind of things.
I mean, they throw a couple other things in there that you get to make choices about that help both mitigate the dice rolling luck as well as, like, just kind of, like, add in damage or mitigate damage or whatever. Like, you know, every character has powers that they can use once per area, right? we had a little bit of confusion over how to refer to the different, like, levels of rooms and stuff, because there's rooms, and then there's, like, every floor has three more types of areas that you go through, which are apparently called areas, and then there's floors, right? So there's like, three different levels of location, essentially, in the game. But for every area, you can flip your character over once to either use an exploration power that helps you kind of navigate the dungeon and get through a little faster or easier, or you can use it for a battle ability that maybe, like, you know, like for Jason was playing the rogue character, and so it, like, doubles one of his die rolls when he uses it. And I was playing the wizard the second time, so it allows me to basically replicate one of the potion effects in the game, so I can, like, you know, do a fire attack or an ice attack, something like that, right?
Yeah.
And so it gives you just enough tools to feel like you have some control over the combat, but that there is still a healthy amount of luck involved, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but it's fun. I think it's a pretty good mix of those things. So it is fun, not necessarily like frustrating in a way where you just feel like it's all completely random.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that it's got charming art. We talked about that a little bit while we were playing, is that the art is charming. However, I think one of the greatest weaknesses of the game is that the art does not always match the monster you're fighting. Right? Because right, there's like, yeah, there's like four different lines on these tables that give you the monster stats. And if you're on floor one, then you use the top row of the table. If you're on floor two, you use the second row of the table, and so on. And each one of those has a different name for the monster that you're fighting, but there's only one piece of artwork on the card. So it might say rat, but you're looking at a skeleton, for instance.
Yeah.
And we kind of talked about it, and we're like, it's a little thing. It's not a big deal, but there could have been some, you know, relatively easy ways to, you know, solve that problem, if you want to consider a problem, you know, like have all four of the monsters that could be represented, like, in the artwork, right? Or, like, have, like, a quadrant of images at the top of the card, each showing, you know, the different monsters that you're potentially fighting. But other than that, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a $20-$25 game. It plays in a relatively short period of time, relatively light rule set, and I think it's one of those games that packs a pretty big punch for a small game.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is, you know, that's pretty awesome. I think that's, it's one of those things that I feel like I appreciate when I find it, because not every small game can give that rich of an experience.
Yeah, it is. It does pack a whole lot of punch for such a little game, little box.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a big hit. Gabe liked that too. He was curious about whether or not it would be at the show, because he wanted to pick up a copy for himself. But as far as we know, it was not. The publisher was not. It looks like I was looking at their expansions online last night, and it looks like maybe they have paired up with Ares a little bit, and I wasn't looking for them at Ares when we were at the Ares booth.
Right.
But I wonder if, like, I just missed it, because, like, there's, like, the boxes for Mini Rogue could easily be, like, tucked up, you know, like, on the side of the, yeah, like, the checkout register table or something like that, right? Like, we could have easily missed it if it was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that night, after standing in line for your vaccination ban for over an hour, right, we eventually made it back to the hotel room, exhausted, and we played one game that night, Unmatched.
The perennial favorite,
that's right. How's Unmatched holding up for you, Jason?
I mean, it's still pretty fun.
It's probably one of the games that we've played the most number of times since starting this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
If not the most number of times.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those games that, like, even if I haven't played it in a while, it's simple enough that, like,
you jump right in.
I can just jump right in and, like, yep, within a couple of minutes, like, know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Which is really great. There's minimal setup involved. And
very minimal.
I mean, it can play kind of long depending on how much you want to think about your turn, but it doesn't actually seem that long because turns go pretty quick.
We also never played for more than an hour. We were playing three-player games, which the rules don't technically
support. Yeah, they don't support, yeah.
Right. But we just say, whatever, like, you know, like, we'll self-balance, you know, like, if one person's getting completely beat up, then you just kind of, like, instinctually stop bagging on that person and try to go after the person with the most health to try to keep things relatively balanced in a 1v1v1 match. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's worked out pretty well. Like, at least one of the games we played this weekend, everybody, like, I think, like, you went out of the game first, but it was, like, one turn before the next person went out, and then, like, you know, the game was over. So it's not like anybody's being eliminated 20 minutes earlier than anybody else or anything like that. It's like single digit minutes at most.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that continues to be fun. We continue to think that Unmatched is a fantastic, like, light to middleweight game that can be played in under an hour. Very satisfying, you know, medium sized game. So Unmatched still rocks.
Yeah, for sure.
So that was day zero. Was there anything else about day zero that we should touch on that you can think of, Jason? I mean, it was mostly kind of like just getting checked in and settled in.
I mean, I would note that although day zero, the line for getting the vaccine banned was really, really long, I've heard from other people and seen on Reddit and stuff that the line on other days was like not long at all. It took like less than 5 minutes.
Right. I mean, well, like Milo and I walked right up to the counter on Saturday morning. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And when I got there earlier on Wednesday afternoon, and it was a long line. Like it stretched down the one hallway.
Yeah.
But that isn't even close to what it did when we were there Wednesday evening with you and Gabe. It like wrapped in and around and through multiple times all of the hallways upstairs.
I didn't
upstairs.
Even know where we were by the time we got to the end.
It was a maze. And when I was in the line, it only took me 20 minutes to get from in the line and out entirely, right? Like, I don't know how much time you and I and Gabe spent in line, but it was over an hour. I think it was less than an hour and a half, but it was somewhere between like an hour to an hour and a half. So it moves fast. Yeah. They moved it fast, but it, you know, like we were in line. And it's like, you know what? These vaccinations probably aren't preventing a lot of people from getting ill, because we know that vaccinations, while they help people from getting, like, you know, severely ill for sure, they don't necessarily prevent infection. So we were kind of like, why are they making us do this? You know, like the whole time.
Yeah.
But I think it probably makes a lot of people feel safer about being there, and it probably helps people feel safer and actually attend. Because we heard a lot of, like, online, especially the previous year, like, I just don't feel safe yet. You know, I'm just not ready yet.
Exactly.
So I bet it helped a lot of people just feel better about going. So probably worth it in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, day one, real Gen Con, day one Thursday. early in the morning, we get up, we have a little breakfast, and then we go shopping for 2 to 3 hours. We did line up for the exhibition hall. We rushed the booths that we wanted to rush. You had a very successful Gen Con as far as rushing booths go.
I did.
I kind of didn't, and then kind of did. You went straight for My Father's Work, correct?
Yeah, I went straight to the Renegade booth for My Father's Work, which I managed to get. And then I also managed to pick up a copy of Acropolis shortly after that. I can't remember what else I bought that first day. Oh, Wormholes.
Right.
And Wormholes came with a free game.
Yeah. I tried to get the Twilight Inscription game by going to where the map said Twilight, or where Fantasy Flight would be. And it turned out that was just their demo area. They didn't have a booth for sales this year. And so I wandered around for about 5 minutes, maybe even 10, trying to figure out where I was supposed to be. Finally asked somebody, hey, are you guys selling that game? And he said, at the Miniature Market booth.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran back to the Miniature Market booth and got in their very long line. And after standing in the line for about 10 minutes, somebody said, oh, they're out of Twilight Inscription. And then somebody said, yeah, we only have 50 copies a day. So I wandered around, sad, doing my Charlie Brown walk, trying to find anything else that could bring me joy. And eventually I wandered by Family Time Games' booth, which is one of the local stores here in Indianapolis. And they had like 6 copies up on their top shelf. And I bought it.
Happy surprise.
Yeah. So I got real lucky there. Thank you, Family Time Games. You were there for me when Fantasy Flight was not. So good on you. Anyway, so we did some shopping, and after that, we finally did our first ticketed event, which was Lords of Valla Dragonbond. And this is a game that we talked about in the preview show that I said it had the potential of being like sort of a asymmetrical team-based game. Because that was kind of the sales pitch, right?
Kind
it was like
of.
One person's playing a general, one person's playing a dragon on two sides, or I guess like four sides. There's two dragons and two generals, right?
You start off as four different sides.
It's a 1v1, V1v1. But you can bond with a dragon if you are a general or vice versa, and then you become a team, and then you're sort of like the score that you're trying to hit in terms of victory points changes from 10 to 15 combined. So 10 for one person versus 15 combined when you're a bonded team. And we played that, which involves like a lot of like clever stacking a deck so that the actions that you select for yourself come out in a very prescribed order, so that, you know, you have to think about what you're going to do ahead of time and plan for like where you want your people to be, and other people's actions and movements and attacks and stuff can really like upset the order of things, so that now
the thing that I thought was interesting about that was that like you could stop the round by just passing.
Yeah.
Like, if one person passes, that's it. Nobody else gets to put any cards down. I thought that was, like, an insane amount of control to put on one person.
Yeah, when you're loading the deck, right? I mean, like, once the actual gameplay has started out of the deck, you know, when everybody's drawing the cards that they put into that deck of cards, nobody can just stop it prematurely then, but you can stop people from being able to, like, plan out their future turns in that deck-building phase. Yeah. It's not really deck-building in a deck-builder sense, but, like, you're building one deck that everybody's going to be drawing one card from per turn.
Right.
Or one card at a time that, you know, and then that whatever card comes out, like, tells one player at the table, you get to move some units, you get to attack somebody, by, you know, and so on and so on. So what did you think of Lords of Valhalla, Dragon Bond?
I mean, I think it was all right. It wasn't anything to write home about for me. I think the main thing was that one of the draws here was this ability to be able to team up with, like, your character and a dragon character.
It sounds so promising,
right?
It
does, yeah, but it turns out that mechanic is actually incredibly hard to actually realize. Like,
yeah.
To make the bonding happen is very hard.
Yeah, like, just setting it up is difficult, right? Because, like,
yeah.
You have to, one character has to enter the zone that another character's in without triggering a combat.
Right,
and
yeah.
As far as we saw, and then maybe there's cards that allow you to do this, but with just the basic abilities, the only characters that have the ability to do that are the dragons.
Yeah.
So a dragon has to enter a general space. If the general uses his ability to enter a dragon space, it does trigger combat.
Mm-hmm.
So unless there's other ability cards that I didn't notice or we didn't see that prevent the combat from happening, then it's all the impetus is on the dragons to form the bond, right? Or to at least,
right,
like,
yeah.
Initiate the bonding phase.
Right.
Then both players have to roll a 10-sided die. There were 10-sided dice, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they both have to roll, like, a symbol, right? Which the symbols are only present on maybe, like, half the sides or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one time we got into a position where we got to attempt a bond during that game, it just didn't happen. Like, it was a complete failure. And then, you know, the only other times anybody tried to do a bond, it was like I was trying to initiate a bond, and then I realized, oh, right, I'm a general. If I go into your space, I'm going to initiate combat, which I definitely don't want to do right now.
Right, yeah.
So it was one of these games where, like, the promise of it, the thing that we were hoping to get out of it, just didn't occur. Which was
right,
a bit of a
yeah.
disappointment.
Yeah, it was a little weird. Other than that, I mean, it's a pretty straightforward, just, you know, 1v1v1v1.
Yeah, yeah, with, like, you know, sort of, like, action selection, card mechanics.
I
was a little... it's a prototype, right? Like, it's... or at least it's, like, an early copy. I was a little disappointed in just the aesthetic of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
The board was a bit drab, and I had a little bit of a difficult time always easily telling where the lineation was between all of the different zones on the board, because it's a lot of, like browns or reds that look like browns to me. So I don't know if it's because I'm a colorblind individual or just because they chose such a muted color palette, but it was a little difficult to see all the things that I wanted or needed to see on the board.
Yeah.
And I just didn't find it very visually appealing, you know?
Yeah. So they tried to, it's a map, and they tried to make it look like it was on parchment, and
yeah.
But that does unfortunately result in a very drab color palette, and you're not alone. Like, the delineations between the different zones were a little difficult to tell.
Right, yeah. I mean, the art on the card, the artwork on the cards seemed better.
Yeah.
And the miniatures are really great. They look
oh,
really
yeah.
cool. So, I mean, all of that is really well done and everything. And I think that the mechanics are, they're at least worth a look if you're interested in these sort of, like, you know, it's like a dudes on a map game, but with basically, like, one miniature and then a bunch of tokens that represent the rest of your army.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if that sounds like something you might be interested in, I'd say it's still worth a look because it has some relatively interesting mechanics, but it just didn't sing for me the first time we played it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe it has further potential that we didn't see. After that, we went to our yearly game of Demon Hunters, which is a role-playing game. I got to play a kangaroo, an android kangaroo named Bruce,
yeah.
B-R-O-O-C-E. Who were you, Jason? You were,
I played the yep. scion of a storied demon hunting family.
Mm-hmm.
I played Ichabod Van Helsing, a sort of gentleman demon hunter.
Yeah. So we had a big 2.5-3 hour RPG session. Demon Hunters is always a little bit, you know, kind of off the rails, silly, funny, you know, like a little bit goofy. You know, it can also be kind of macabre, but in a very silly, goofy way. Yeah. It has a tone that I really enjoy, and I continue to enjoy. And almost every Gen Con, one of my favorite things is always playing Demon Hunters. So, you know, I think we continue to have a good time doing that.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
Your character came with a win button, basically.
Kind of, yeah.
we got into the final confrontation with the big boss of the whole thing, and Jason invoked a power on his sheet that just basically lets him get into a situation where he can or cannot win the entire thing.
Right, yeah. It basically lets me challenge an enemy to a duel, and if I win the duel, they have to surrender to me.
Yeah. And you won.
And I won.
So the game was over, and we finished our game of Demon Hunters at least 20 or 30 minutes earlier than the table running parallel to us. So that was interesting.
It was kind of fun, actually.
It was pretty fun. And then that night, we went to a 8 o'clock game of Kingdom Death Monster. But not just any game, a 48-hour game of Kingdom Death Monster. So this is a game that was running for 48 hours straight, and we happened to be the group that started the entire civilization.
Yeah.
So we were the very first characters on the board. We fought the Prologue Lion, and then we went straight into a year one fight with Gorm, who is one of the expansion monsters who neither of us had ever really seen or played against. Well, I've seen him. I own him. But we had not played against Gorm in any of the campaigns that I've played in. So we got to make the starting survivors, set up make all the early decisions for the civilization that we were building, name a bunch of people, see a bunch of people die, and we did that for 3 hours, and that was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun.
I mean, no surprise, I enjoyed Kingdom Death Monster. I know we were both on record as enjoying that game, and,
yeah,
you know, I'm on record as having enjoyed it a whole lot, you know, like in the amount of time that I've spent with it, which I believe is quite a bit more than you at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that these characters were going to persist past our time with them, right, and that you could come back and check in on them later on in the weekend, which Gabe did for us, right?
Yeah.
Like maybe you were with him.
I was with him.
I was separated at the time, so I was getting texts about my boy Snarf and how he made it all the way to year 10, but then was taken in the night. Yeah. That was really fun. Like, just thinking about, oh my gosh, I wonder how my boy Snarf is doing with all these other people. I hope they treat him well, you know? It was like your kids went off to college, you know, for, you know, surviving and killing monsters in a really dark land. But that was awesome. That was awesome. It only started to drag at the very end after we'd been playing for 2.5 hours. And then it was like bookkeeping time,
right,
after all of that. And it was like, oh, I'm a little too tired for this right now, bud. But then we went back to the room and we played Guild of Merchant Explorers, which is a newer game from AEG that I picked up at the show. Partially because it looked really pretty, and then when you were buying wormholes at their booth, they pointed out that if you spent $50 on a game, they were going to throw in a free game. And I was already enticed by the game enough that I was like, well, free game plus the thing I'm already kind of looking at? Sure thing, bud. And so I bought that game, and then we went back and we played it in the room. What did you think of Guild of Merchant Explorers, Jason?
I thought it was fine. I thought it was a decent game, actually. I don't know. It's a very, for a competitive game, it's like incredibly non-confrontational because
very multiplayer solitaire.
Yeah, like everybody has their own board and there's no interaction between player boards, and you'd take all your own actions, use all your own tokens, and, you know, it's not sort of, I guess the competition lies in just trying to get a better score than the next person.
That's entirely it.
Yeah.
It's very much a non roll and write. Like, you
you have
like a hex map in front of you, basically the same size as most, you know, like bigger roll and write maps. And it's there's a bunch of different, you have a starting location in the center of the map, and you kind of like just work your way out based on, what do we do? Do we roll dice to determine where we got to go, or no, it was cards,
no, it was
right?
Cards.
There's cards with hex. You pull a card, and there's like one or two hexes that it shows that you get to like kind of mark off, basically, and you kind of create like sort of like directional combos and stuff in order to unlock more points and other rewards. And it works very similarly to a lot of sort of like hex exploring roll and writes that I've played in the last couple of years. Only you're using actual wooden pieces to keep track of where you're at on the map, and you know you're. I don't know, like putting down tokens and stuff to mark things off instead of like writing on them. And then, you know, you're taking, you know, cardboard tokens representing points or money into your player area to keep track of your score and everything. So very similar to a lot of Roll and Writes, which I do enjoy. It's a very sort of a relaxed, chill experience. It's not the sort of thing that's going to, like, you know, create a bunch of excitement, and like, you're not going to have people banging down your door saying like, let's play the Guild of Merchant Explorers. I've been waiting all week. You know, it's not Battlestar Galactica or Twilight Imperium or whatever. But you know, a pretty nice, relaxing way to end a pretty busy day, I thought.
Yeah.
It's a good wind down game, I guess.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, pretty successful game there. Then we went to bed day two, Friday. We went back to the show floor, I think, that morning.
We had an event that we didn't go to because it was far away.
It was. But we, the first thing we did was Mall Hero Paranormal Activity.
Oh, yeah.
Where we did a role-playing game that was run by a GM named Todd Hoag, who I had remembered the name of from a previous Mall Hero experience I had like 10 years ago or something. And we had such a good time in his game then that I've always looked for games by him since. And I think he kind of said that this was the last year he was going to be running games at Gen Con.
I think that's what he said, yeah.
And so he was kind of sunsetting this setting and these characters, and we happened to get to play in that game.
Yeah.
So we were a bunch of teens working in a mall, and it's crazy. Like with the team that I was playing was a girl who works at a Build-A-Bear shop, and like she had the previous year become the Grim Reaper and like had to like basically like choose between like life and death for certain people or heaven and hell. And she's like very indecisive. So she had like this terrible time doing that. And in our particular version of the game, like she was no longer the Grim Reaper, but, things went real crazy, real fast. And a little teddy bear was running around trying to take people to, you know, like to the afterlife, and kept referring to her as mommy and stuff. You were playing a kiosk guy who was very unhappy with his kiosk lot in life.
Everybody looked down on him because he didn't work in a real store.
But anyway, I mean, that has always been like a very fast moving RPG. We didn't use any rolling mechanics. It was all just total role playing, like actual RP.
Yeah.
How did you feel about that, Jason? That might have been the first time that you have played a pure RP game before, I bet.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to distinguish with those things, like where the game ends and where just like play acting begins.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I thought it was interesting for that reason. I had a good time doing it. Mm-hmm. I don't know as I would call it a game so much, but but it was fun.
So, I mean, I love it, right? Like, no surprise, I like acting. Maybe that is a surprise to people. Not everybody knows me, right? But, like, that part of it, the sort of performative aspect of it, appeals to me pretty greatly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've... Plus, just the tone of the game and like, the DM's sense of humor and sort of his... He has a... That particular GM has a very good ability. He's really, really fast at thinking on his feet and reacting to what the players are doing in a very believable way for the characters and in a very funny way as well. So, I think, like, playing off of him is very easy for me, right?
Yeah.
Because he is very funny, and he's very smart, and he's very clever. And so, he helps kind of, like, drag that out of other players. So I had a great time doing that, and I'm really sad that he won't be there in the future if that is actually the case.
Yeah.
And that we'll never be able to do that again. But that was a blast for me. After that, we kind of took some time off, but then we eventually made our way over to Killzone Live.
I forgot about this.
It's a Kill Team Live, Killzone, Kill Team Live, something like that. It was basically the Games Workshop Kill Team game, which is how I basically got my feet into the Games Workshop Warhammer pool. They were running a laser tag arena where you split up into two teams. One team is the orcs and one team is the Imperial Guard. And they've actually sort of like organized or adjusted the settings on the different guns that you can have, the lasers, right? So that there's different values for health and the amount of damage and the firing rate and the reload rate of these different weapons. So it's actually an asymmetrical laser tag game. And it was objective based, just like Kill Team is. So there's like three spots on the three boxes out in the battlefield, and somebody on your team shoots the box, and it starts blinking a color that matches your team. So like we were the blue team, even though we were the orcs, and the green skins are blue. And so you, the more time you hold those points, the better your chance of winning at the end is, right? I mean, whoever holds those points the most, whoever has the most time of holding those points is the winner at the end of the game.
Yeah.
So that was your first time ever playing laser tag, right, Jason?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah?
Yep.
And it was my first time playing Kill Team Live, that version of laser tag. I had so much fun doing that.
It was a good time. Think? Yeah. I mean, I didn't quite know what to, I mean, I kind of knew what to expect in that way that, like, I've seen things, you know, I've seen laser tag games played on, like, TV or, like, other people have played them and stuff, but I've never actually done one, so in that respect, I didn't know what to expect, and it was a lot of fun. Very stressful.
But in a fun way, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's very, I don't know, like, my heart was pounding the whole time.
That's called excitement, Jason.
Well, I know, but, you know, when you get to be this old, you never know.
I had maybe the best time I had at Gen Con were those 8 minutes we were out on that battlefield. We asked him how long the battle was going to last, and he's like, it's 8 minutes, but it'll feel like 30. Which wasn't, I wouldn't have said 30, but maybe if you told me, like, 20, I could have believed that.
It definitely felt longer than 8 minutes.
Definitely. Every time I looked up at the board to see the timing down, I was like, wow, really? There's still 4 minutes left? Holy cow. So I don't know. That was awesome. I loved that. Then we kind of started I think it was close to 6 hours of us just gaming by ourselves in the board game hall.
Yep.
The open gaming hall in the JW Marriott. And we started with Atlantis Rising, which is a cooperative worker placement game. How often do you hear those words all put together? The answer is not often.
Yeah, not very.
Yeah. Co-op Euro mechanics, not very common, you know? And so this is a game that my wife and I purchased in the last year because she misses playing Euro games, but she doesn't really like playing competitive games all that much. So when I found out that Atlantis Rising was a cooperative Euro game, a worker placement game, I kind of put it on a list of things that I was interested in getting, and one day it was like on sale on one of the discount retailers or whatever, and I grabbed a copy. And so, Jason, we tried that out.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll go into a deeper review someday on this one, because I feel like I've played it twice now.
Yeah, we probably should.
You played it once. Yeah. But, I mean, like, just right now, overall, like, quick response to how it played and what you thought about it. What would you say?
I liked it. I thought it was a really well-designed Euro game that didn't quite feel like a Euro game.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I like games like, you know, we talked about this, like Forbidden Island and Forbidden Desert and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And it has that kind of like ticking clock kind of scenario to it.
For sure, yeah.
Which I really enjoy. But it's also not as, I think you have more control over it, I think, mm-hmm. than you do in either of the previous two games that I mentioned.
Yeah.
Which is good. So you definitely have to like rely on people to, you know, choose wisely with their worker placement stuff and.
There's still some elements that aren't entirely in your control because you're drawing from a deck of cards to see which parts of Atlantis start sinking every round, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, like multiple times per round. And you're also rolling dice on some of the actions that you take in order to see if you succeed or fail at acquiring the resources that you are trying to get with those workers. But there's dice mitigation mechanics in place. There's, you know, mitigation for Atlantis sinking, right? So it you know, when you say it doesn't feel like quite as random or quite as out of your control as a game of Forbidden Island or Forbidden Desert, that's definitely by design, right? And you certainly have full control over things like worker placement mechanics, which, you know, like in a game like Agricola is very deterministic, right? Like,
right.
I put my worker over here, I'm going to get that thing. As long as I can put my worker there before somebody else does, right? And in this game, you can talk about, I need to get this because I've got, you know, these other resources, so I need to be in the forge or whatever in order to turn this ore into a bar of iron or whatever, Atlantium. so, you know, like, there's even more control than a typical worker placement game, other than the fact that that worker might get sucked into the ocean.
Right. Well, the worker doesn't actually get sucked into the ocean. It just goes back to your pool, but...
But thematically, what happened to that worker when that part of the island sinks?
Well,
he's definitely that particular thematic worker is not coming back to your worker pool. You're bringing the next dude up in line. That's his understudy.
Next up.
Yeah. After that, we set up the game Oath.
Next.
I want to talk about this a little bit. I think it's worth talking about. We played Oath last year at Gen Con using the tutorial, and that tutorial kind of takes you through the first couple of rounds and then kind of lets you go, right?
Yeah.
So you got your training wheels on for the first couple of rounds, and then you take the training wheels off and you go. And when we did that last year in the room, it was fine.
Yeah.
We played a full game of Oath without any real problems, and it was complete. A complete game with very few mistakes or confusion or anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
I read the rule book and watched a video, and we did not use the tutorial this year because we wanted to pick the game up where we left it off last year.
Right.
Because Oath is a game that is played in sort of like generations where the game state at the beginning of a game is kind of determined by the end game state from the previous game. And it was impenetrable.
Yeah, and none of us were like, do we know what we're doing?
Yeah, it's like none of this makes any sense. There's so many different like varieties of ways that all of these different mechanics, like, you know, like attacking, fighting works differently if you're the attacker versus if you're the defender versus if you're the king type person. What's it called?
The chancellor.
Chancellor. If you're the chancellor versus an exile versus a citizen, it's all different. And so if you don't know the rules by heart, oh my gosh, what a nightmare that game is. And we had two people come over and talk to us about the game while we were trying to play it.
Yeah.
One guy was like, "That's my favorite game." And another guy's like, "Hey, how many times have you played the game?" And we're like, "Once last year and once this year." And he's like, "Haha, two times in a year. That's about right." And he's like, "Are you enjoying it?" And we were like, "We don't know."
We don't know yet.
"I played it several times and I still don't know." So Oath remains a mystery, but it's a mystery that I'm still determined to try to solve because I still want to try starting over from scratch on Tabletop Simulator where they have the tutorial kind of set up. I think we need to try that again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to try it, you know, with Gabe, who was there trying to play it with us, because I think he's a pretty good sport about these types of things. And he's very patient with these games that are a little bit difficult to figure out. But also, when we started with the tutorial version of the game, I think the game state was a lot more even and fair. When we started over the weekend, you playing the Chancellor just basically had presence all over the board. And when Gabe and I were talking about how we could possibly achieve certain goals, it just seemed impossible. So I think I'd rather, if we're going to start again, we probably need to start where it doesn't feel punishingly impossible for those of us that still don't know how to play.
Right, yeah.
You know,
I feel like with games that are that complex, they're either brilliant or just really pretentious. And I don't know which one this is.
I mean, my gut tells me that this is brilliant and it's probably really interesting and compelling, if not fun at a certain level, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, maybe there's just straight up fun to be had in there, but it definitely feels like a game where there will be satisfaction if you can get the game to do some of the things that you want it to do.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to figure out how to do those things.
Yeah,
yeah. And that is not easy. So, again, we still have no idea what to think of Oath. After that, we set up a little demo game that you got.
Critical,
yeah, which is the elevator pitch for this is that it's a role-playing game that all of the prep work is basically done for you as the GM. So you can just kind of like set it up. There's character cards. There's, you know, cards for all of the gear and weapons and stuff that you might use in the game. It's set in like sort of a futuristic cyberpunky sort of setting. It's got like a DM screen and everything. We didn't get the full game, but they threw in the like sort of like Mission Zero, Episode Zero thing for you when you bought another game at their booth.
Yeah.
So what was that like to run, Jason?
It was real easy.
Yeah,
it's basically a script. You know, it tells you, it gives you all the dialogue to say. It outlines, like, if they ask this, this is what you say. If they ask this, this is what you say. And, like, gives you, like, when and how to reveal certain information and all this kind of stuff. You know, when they come to this point, this is the thing they have to do, and this is the point, the checkpoint they have to reach, and so on and so forth. So it's very, very scripted. There's very little room for sort of maneuvering around what's already been written.
There's, like, no real, like, creativity space for the players either.
Yeah, no, I feel like trying to RP in this situation would be really difficult.
We kind of just railroaded our way through the, like, okay, what's the objective we need to do? Okay, do that. All
right. Right, yeah.
Roll the die. All right. Now we're in here. What is the objective we need to do? Okay, I try to do that. All right, roll the die. Okay. And so it was probably the dullest role-playing experience I've had all year. Not to say that it's probably completely without value. Like, I could see maybe wanting to get some people that had never played role-playing games to start playing role-playing games. This might be a good tool for that. Or you've got, like, a group of people who don't need a very complex role-playing game and they really want to play, and you've got a GM who really doesn't have time or want to, like, you know, invest a lot of time into setting up a complex campaign. I mean, maybe it's good for that, but for those of us who spent a good deal of time this weekend playing real role-playing games and who every Friday play a D&D game online, I would say it has no value.
I mean, that's the way you described it was kind of how the guy at the booth described it to me, was that it's designed for people for whom running a quote-unquote normal RPG would be a little bit of a heavy lift.
And there it makes sense, right? Yeah. But I mean, like, I wouldn't play it instead of playing D&D with my friends when we've got somebody like you who is currently GMing our campaign very successfully, and it's really fun, right? Yeah. Like, our D&D campaign has gone crazy so many times in so many ways, and that's really the joy of role-playing for me, is when things get weird and funny, right? When we're laughing, not whether or not we rolled the right number. So that game isn't really set up to provide those sorts of experiences. Yeah. It's set up to provide here's a storyline, work your way through it. Hopefully these stats and these cards help facilitate your success, you know? And if that's what you want to do, cool. You know, like, that's there. But it's not that different from a lot of board games that provide very similar experiences. They just happen to happen on a board, you know?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So Critical, I don't know. Like, I would try it again to see if a more full experience, like the full Critical, game provides like a richer experience than just that little like sample we got, basically. Yeah. But the sample felt pretty slight. Yeah. So you know,
I mean, we played that scenario in like what, less than 15 minutes.
Yeah. So I mean, like, I didn't come away from that thinking, oh, I gotta go buy this, and it was on my list of things that I wanted to go and check out. I think the other thing is, if it were fully co-op, like fully single, like you could run it without a GM, if it was one of those types of games, that might change things a little bit. But the notion that you're running this game that's completely predetermined and somebody has to be the GM rather than can be a player who's also just kind of reading along the script or whatever, like, I don't really, that's not great.
Yeah.
But maybe you could run it that way. I don't know. I guess we didn't actually see anything that says that you couldn't have also controlled a character, right?
Right.
Yeah. Anyway. After that, we played Acropolis with a K.
With a K.
Yeah. Tiles.
Yeah.
City building.
Yeah.
Color matching.
Yeah.
Color positioning.
Color positioning.
These are the things that Acropolis does.
It does, yeah. I mean, it's a tiling game. There's different districts that are different colors, and then there are multipliers for those colors, and they also get multiplied by the level of the city on which they are. And so you can build the tiles on top of each other to multiply the number of points that they're worth or whatever else. And that's basically it.
It's like when we were playing the game, I said, this really reminds me of King Domino, but there's variable ways that the different colored tiles, the different districts score, or even become like active force scoring. And so in that sense, it's, and the fact that it's a hexagonal game rather than a domino game, it's like a good, healthy step up in complexity and strategy from King Domino.
Yeah.
Like, if you've played King Domino as your gateway game into this sort of thing, and you're like, man, I've played 200 games of King Domino, I'd sure like to play something similar, but, you know, like, different and more creative and, you know, like a step forward in terms of game design, this is your game.
Yeah.
This exists for you or anyone else that wants to play like a relatively casual, but very sort of like very crunchy, satisfying and very visually appealing, like relatively lightweight game. Like it kind of hits a Goldilocks zone for a lot of things for me.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. I think it's a very,
it's Very good game.
Very good game.
Yeah. I like that there's, I like the, now I forgot about this when I was planning out my city, but I got it to maybe like level twos in several places, but there's a verticality to the game as well, because you can lay tiles on top of other tiles to build like a multi-tiered city. And the higher up those tiles are, as long as they're activated for scoring, they're worth, you know, like more points. Like a tile on level one is worth, you know, like points times one, right? And and if it goes up a level, now it's points times two and three and four and so on, right? Yeah. I don't know if there's like an upper limit for that or what, but that's really interesting. And it creates a very visually appealing tableau in front of you, which is really cool,
yeah,
right?
Games that involve verticality, I really like.
Yeah, absolutely. So Acropolis was a big win. I mean, it's not like the deepest, most complex game. Like we said, it's relatively lightweight, but it succeeds very well at being that kind of a lightweight game.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah, so thumbs up, I think, from everybody around the table on Acropolis. Then we played Wormholes.
Wormholes.
A pick-up-and-deliver game about sort of hand management and putting down wormholes.
The wormholes are really just sort of to
facilitate
like the delivering of goods.
Faster movement. Like, yeah, I mean, if you want to go to one side of the galaxy and you happen to lay the wormholes just correctly to let yourself more easily get from that side of the galaxy, from that side of the galaxy to the other, you have succeeded at using the wormholes mechanic. I did not do that.
I didn't either. I thought I was trying to be much more strategic with my wormhole placement, and I think the I think it errs on the side of it's better to place a wormhole than not.
So I feel like you could play this game by trying to manage the wormhole placement to allow yourself to deal with a bad hand of cards throughout the entire game. Mm. Or you can try to deal with the hand of cards, right?
Yeah.
Because you can there's certain mechanics to allow you to sort of get rid of certain cards that you don't feel like you can easily deliver, to try to make matching hands of cards to then like get a lot of points at once when you just manage to get to, you know, one of the nine planets and you happen to hold like three cards for that planet. That's a way to really min-max the amount of points that you're getting for the number of actions that you put into that delivery, right? Yeah. Which is how I was trying to play the game. But the RNG just was not working with me. Like, I was not getting any matching cards throughout the game. And so my whole game just completely fell apart. And I didn't utilize the wormholes effectively. And I didn't get lucky enough with the card draw or the card management to make the game, that the way that I was playing the game, work. So I had a pretty sad game of wormholes.
I feel like for all of that, you and I had fairly close scores. The one that really ran away with the game was Gabe.
Yeah. You had some pretty satisfying turns where you got to like unload like three cards at a time or whatever. But
it didn't help that much.
But whatever. Well, I think the other thing was like I was one of the ones that was, I was also trying to rush to planets because one of the things that you can do to score points is to be the first to put a wormhole next to a planet.
Yeah.
And I was trying to rush that mechanic because I knew I was not keeping up with you guys in terms of just the straight up deliveries. And that brought us a little closer in terms of points. I think you were like 19 and I was like 18 or something like that. But yeah, Gabe had like, who knows? I don't even remember.
Yeah,
like,
I don't remember.
Way higher than that. Let's just say 40. Who knows?
I feel like another part of this game that we didn't really use, you and I didn't use very well, was that like you can use other people's wormholes now.
Yeah, but I did. You give them points. When
I
you
know,
do that,
but
I didn't
it also.
Do that, so.
I know. So if you use somebody else's wormhole, they get a point. But it's also like if that helps you get to a planet faster and deliver like a couple cards, like it might be worth it.
If the hand is right, right?
Yeah.
You got to make sure that the swing between you and the person that you're feeding points to, that it's enough not to just put them further ahead or to just keep neck and neck with them if they're already leading ahead of you and everything.
Yeah.
And I wasn't keeping track well enough, so I just never did it. I was like, that feels bad, and I really feel like I'm in the I'm the caboose right here, so I'm not going to do it, right? I'm going to play hardball in these wormholes. but, you know, aside from that, just aside from the game just not working in my favor in terms of like the scoring and everything and the cards that came out, like, it's a solid game design, right?
Yeah,
and it's a visually appealing game. I think that it's a success. I wouldn't say that it's a bad game, or even that I didn't have fun. I just had a bad game.
I
scored poorly, you know. But I mean, it was fun. It was fun to play.
Yeah, and there are instructions for like randomizing the board too, so it.
Yeah.
You can, you know, change it around a little.
Yeah. And that was the end of Friday, day two. So on day three, on Saturday, I separated from you and Gabe because that was when Milo and I were doing our Killer Queen and Tabletop Escape Room and all that. Yep. Did you two play anything before Legends of Sleepy Hollow?
No, we didn't. We got breakfast. we did go back to the show floor and walk around for like a good couple hours. And then we went back to the room and took a nap.
Right, and then I woke you up.
Yes.
With Milo,
yes. And then we went to the Legends of Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah, so you played Legend of Sleepy Hollow, which is, I don't know if it was Greater Than Games the official publisher of this game. I feel like I saw other things on the box, but it was in the Greater Than Games room.
It was being run by GTG.
And it was being sold at their booth
on the floor. Yeah, it was also at their booth, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure who the publisher is on that, because I know they've got like several sub like imprints and everything. Yeah. Why don't you talk about Legends of Sleepy Hollow? Because all I did was I walked into the room about three or four times and said, "Are you guys done yet? Are you guys done yet?" That's not actually what I said, but I was just kind of like checking the game out, right? Yeah. I wanted to lay eyes on it. It looked really cool, and I saw it on the show floor, and I was like, "Oh, hey, there's this game, Legends of Sleepy Hollow. It's a co-op.
Yeah,
maybe this is the thing that I'll pick up for my wife and I to play together. Maybe this will be our new co-op." And so I kept kind of walking in to say like, should I get it? Is it that good? Should I get it? And neither you or Gabe really had any real strong feedback for me regarding that until towards the end,
yeah,
right?
My response was, you have a ton of these types of games already.
Yeah.
I mean, for all that, I mean, I think Gabe and I both enjoyed playing it. It wasn't terribly complex in the way that a lot of these sort of like dungeon crawly campaign type games can be. So it was, you know, we picked it up kind of right away. There was nothing like really, I don't know, outstandingly different about it. There were a couple of mechanics that I thought were kind of interesting. I think the thing that appealed to me most was the theme of the thing, first of all. So it's sort of like a Gothic American colonial thing. So it's based on the Washington Irving novella, but it actually takes place sort of after that. Like, the main character Ichabod Crane has disappeared, and your job as one of the people in this town is to sort of investigate his disappearance, and you do it over the course of, I think it's like 10 scenarios or something.
Now, you say I don't have any games like this, or that I have lots of games like this, but I don't have any games that I can think of that do a Gothic colonial America theme.
I meant that in the way that it's basically like a campaign dungeon crawler.
Yeah, I know. I'm just making my little jokes.
Yeah. Make your little jokes, Kyle.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but for all that, I mean, I actually just really enjoyed playing the game. I liked.
So if you don't have a massive library of campaign dungeon crawlers.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably a good one to pick up. I mean, it's not, like I said, it's not terribly complicated, so it's not really like a heavy lift. There's not like a huge, massive rule book that you have to read. You know, it's fun enough to play. Combat is relatively satisfying. There's some investigation, exploration kind of aspects to it. And it looks really cool. Not only are the miniatures beautiful, but the boards that you put out to make the different maps are also really great. The first one we played was like a one-room schoolhouse. And then the second one was like a colonial, like Dutch mansion kind of thing. And they looked gorgeous.
I think that might be one of the main draws why I was having such a hard time just letting it go and being like, tell me I don't need this. And then like accepting the message that I didn't need it, because it looked visually so great.
Oh yeah. It's a really nice looking game.
I really wanted to bring it home because the box is gorgeous and the artwork was gorgeous. I really like the sepia tone miniatures.
Yeah.
They just are crying for a wash if they're not already washed, because it kind of looked washed, mm-hmm. but I wasn't sure they were or not, and I was like, I could wash them even more.
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, it looks great.
I mean, one of the things that I really appreciated was that in the second scenario, we were joined by an NPC, and the NPC had its own miniature, instead of just like a token or something.
Uh-huh.
And it was just as detailed and lovely as the rest of the miniatures. I mean, they put a lot of care into it.
This game really, it kind of vibes the same way that, like, Mice and Mystics did for me at first, where, like, it had these just gorgeous boards and, like, you know, great-looking miniatures and everything.
Yeah.
And I like Mice and Mystics. I think I'll like it best if I'm playing it with my 7-year-old, which we haven't started doing yet. But I think the other thing that's kind of, like, for some reason, like, it just kind of, like, It reminded me for some reason visually, as well as like when I was looking at the mechanics, just sort of like the weight of the mechanics and stuff of Death May Die, Cthulhu Death May Die. I don't know if that makes sense to you, having actually played the game, but I was getting a vibe from it that reminded me of that vibe.
It's definitely the same kind of feeling. I feel like Death May Die is harder.
Okay. Well, I mean, that might actually be in a point in favor of Legends of Sleepy Hollow then, as a if you need a co-op, right? If you're looking for a new co-op campaign game, yeah, this might be a good one.
Yeah, because Death May Die can be pretty punishing, but this game was pretty straightforward, especially if like the people playing the individual characters like work well together.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little sad I didn't get to actually try it, because now I'm just left wondering, you know, was it the best game of all time? I don't know. It looks nice.
It does look nice.
After that, you know what we played? Do you remember?
Blood on the Clock Tower.
No. Unmatched.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We played Unmatched.
But we'll skip over that because we've already talked about it. Blood on the Clock Tower.
Yeah.
We played another game of Blood on the Clock Tower, a game that we have been playing now occasionally since 2019. This is the second time we've played a game that was run by somebody else at Gen Con, though.
Yep.
There, of course, was the episode 100, where you ran two games back to back for, us and some friends of the show. So we played Blood on the Clock Tower in person with a group of 17, which I think is the biggest group we've ever played with.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. You had a great time.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Every time I play it, I'm like, I just really like this game.
It's a good game. It's fun. It is fun.
Yeah.
I had a bit of a different experience this time, because the first time we played it, I was the imp, which is, you know, like the big bad of the whole game. And it was a like nail-biting, like intensely anxiety-provoking time for me. This time, I played a character who, at the very beginning of the game, can just say, I know this thing, I learned it on the first night, and then all I was after that point was just another person to either be targeted or to argue with other people, which, you know, doesn't feel all that special. Whereas you were a gunslinger who could kill a person every day, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And also, nobody knew whether you were good or bad. Like, you had that whole secret, and, you know, like, you were the only one who knew, apparently.
Yep.
So, for me, I had a good time. It was fun. It's always fun to do any sort of, you know, social deduction game where you're having a bunch of crisscrossy arguments with some people, and things get heated, and people start, you know, throwing accusations left and right that don't make any sense, and then you're trying to argue some sense into them, but they don't listen to you. And, you know, things continue to go sideways until the bad guys win, which seems to be the case with this game almost every time.
Because no one trusts anyone.
Yeah, yeah. So I had a good time, but, I mean, I don't think that it was, like, it wasn't as high of a high for me as when we played in 2019. So I think, like, who you play as does matter in this game for sure.
Yeah, so that when we first played, I was one of those characters where it was like, well, my power's expended.
Yeah.
But this time I was, like, one of the bad guys, and I had an active role, you know, in every round, and it was way more intense.
I think when you have something that remains active and relevant throughout the course of the game, it's going to be a much higher high for you, right? Mm-hmm. And if you happen to be a character that just becomes a generic character after day one, it starts to slow down a little bit. Like, I was ready for the game to be over when it ended, you know?
Yeah.
It was one of these times where it was a fun time, but I certainly didn't want it to go any longer than it did. But Gabe was also playing, he was the poisoner.
Yeah.
So he was one of the bad guy characters that got to do something every night, and he had a great time as well, I know. So,
yeah.
This game really seems to sing if you happen to be one of the bad characters or one of the characters that happens to have some sort of function in perpetuity throughout the game. But I think I definitely had maybe the, I don't know, like not a bad time at all. It was still fun, but like maybe the mildest game I've had yet of this game. So that was my experience anyway. We have a physical copy of that now, and we touched it and we have looked at it, and we've gotten to see all the different components in there. I've looked through it. I still don't think we're done talking about this game. It's become kind of an LPT thing, I guess. You have said that you want to get your own copy.
Yeah.
And I've said, well, I think we also need to maybe actually do a video of this and maybe like over camera, since we are now in separate cities, take a look at these components individually and talk about them. And then we can talk about what we think of this game as sort of like a final review. I think we should do this as a video thing.
Yeah.
We haven't done a lot of video But I feel like we need to do more, and I feel like Blood on the Clock Tower is one of the first and most worthy things for us to really attack in this method, to talk about the value of the game and whether or not a $145 game is worth it when it gives you this rich of an experience and the components that it's giving you. Because previously what we said was we're not sure the value is there for a $95 game when it's a social deduction game that can be played mostly similarly as something like Werewolf, Ultimate Werewolf, whatever, right? A bunch of games that you can get for $15-$20 or for free, right? You can often download these kinds of games, like the rule sets, for free. But they do give you quite a bit in that box. So we need to take a more granular look at it, I think, to give our sort of final judgment on this thing, because now it's officially out. You can order it on their website and get their full, finished retail product. So we're going to do that at some point. But as of right now, it continues to be a fun time. It just happens to be a lot funner if you're one of the bad guys or you have a role to play throughout the entire game. So after that, we did a little gaming on our own again, and we tried out Twilight Inscription. We didn't have quite enough time to finish the game, but I think we got through maybe a little more than half of a game. So we got to see how it works. We got to see the mechanics. We got to see how it plays, how it feels, how it all works mechanically. What did you think of that, Jason? Let's talk about what is Twilight Inscription. People may not know.
So it's a roll and write game that, I gather that it's trying to sort of distill the, sort of like 6 or 8 hour experience of playing Twilight Imperium into something much more manageable. And I think it does that successfully. So, cause it still has all the components. It still has like the, you know, the warfare, the exploration, the economy stuff, the exploration stuff, has all that stuff in it. But the mechanics are all very streamlined, a little bit more randomized sometimes. And you know, you don't have to move massive mounds of plastic from one tile to another.
There's still sort of variable powers with the different factions, although like far less, you know, like faction powers and stuff than on the player boards, the player mats, when you play a full game of Twilight Imperium. But still enough to evoke the theme and evoke the experience of Twilight Imperium enough to say, this gives me a little bit of what I need when I don't have the time or the people to play a full, like, you know, 7 hour game of Twilight Imperium. Instead, I have 2 hours to do this roll and write game, or an hour and a half or whatever, right? I think it plays like 1 to 2 hours or whatever. And I see that as probably pretty likely. I've read the full rules, and you can play it solo. It comes with like sort of a bot that you can use for 1 or 2 player games. And it looks pretty promising. I've played quite a few roll and write games at this point, and it has a lot of similar sort of functions and mechanics as those games, but it does a very good job of injecting the Twilight Imperium stuff into that formula and evoking the Twilight Imperium feeling from those mechanics. So far I'm very happy with it, and I'm definitely interested in trying out more of it. When I have a little bit extra time, maybe this Friday, I'm gonna set it up and try playing a solo game and see how that goes. So I mean, we can always swing back to this and talk about it again on a later episode. And we can always check to see if somehow people have implemented it online, try a full game. But it seems pretty cool for what it is. Probably going to be my favorite roll and write, that's for sure. After that, we played a little game called The Crew.
Oh, yeah. Oh, The Crew.
The Crew is a small box deck of cards, 2 decks of cards, because one's a little tiny deck of cards, where you are thematically playing a team of spacemans, and you are given a 1 of 50 different tasks. There's like a campaign in the rulebook that basically just sets up variable rules for a trick-taking game. And it's basically just really fancy hearts or euchre or something. And we taught it to our 2 friends who were there with us, and we played a bunch of games that night. Yeah. And then we broke it out again the next night when we had more time. And honest to God, Jason, I still want to play more of The Crew right now. I wish you were here. I wish Gabe was here. I wish Dave was here, and that we were playing The Crew right now.
I would enjoy that.
It turns out that simple trick-taking card games, pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, the reason I think it was so hilarious is because that some of us who shall remain nameless didn't really understand the sort of logic involved with trick-taking games.
Which made it even funnier and more fun.
Yes, it was very fun because of that.
But then also, whenever we won, it was so satisfying. Because it requires a little bit of mind reading, right?
Yeah.
Like, it requires you, like, looking at your friends and saying, why did you play that number? Is there a reason why they would do that? Oh, I'm going to assume that they meant this. And then that one time where you happen to figure it out and you were right about what they meant by that card that they played,
yeah.
It's so satisfying to get on the other end of that, because you're not allowed to talk during the game.
Right.
You have to do it all silently.
About your hand.
You're not allowed to talk about the cards and everything, right? Yeah, and you're not supposed to like really like say anything that would imply anything about your hand or what you have and everything, right? So, I have found the crew to be very great.
It's definitely a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, another one of these things where like it's a small box game. Gabe found it for $7 on Amazon, right?
Yeah.
And for a $7 game, wow, what a great time.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Now, if you're going to tell me that I have to spend $30 for the crew, I'm going to say, haha, very funny, I'll go get a deck of cards,
right?
Right?
Yeah.
But for what it gives you to set up some very specific types of scenarios and some very specific, unique, like sort of like trick-taking tasks, you know, because it has like things like, you know, like you have to take a certain number of tricks in a certain order, or, you know, like we played one where like one person was just not allowed to ever get a trick, right?
Yeah.
Like all these different challenges, in addition to a relatively decent, like looking cards, you know, like the artwork, the graphic design and everything on them, I feel like works to the theme enough that I think it's worth $7. You know,
yeah.
It's worth $15,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But if you tell me that, like, you know, I have to spend $30 on this thing, I'd say, no, that's too much, right? That's not what this is. But for a, like, you know, like $7 to $15 game, it's pretty great.
Yeah, and easily one of the better things I think we did this weekend.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. Twilight Imperium, we played that Sunday.
Yes. It is well documented how we feel about this game.
Yeah, we're fans of Twilight Imperium. It continues to be a long, exhausting, but also very satisfying and fun game. You will probably know by now whether or not you're interested in Twilight Imperium. If you are unfamiliar with Twilight Imperium while we're talking here, go back and listen to our 25th episode of the podcast, because that is the game that we review there. And I think my feelings for it have only maybe slightly changed since then. I'm maybe not quite as rabidly like awaiting my next Twilight Imperium game as I used to be, because I've played many of them since then. But it still continues to be, you know, one of my favorite experiences in board games. I do wish that Todd would stop winning. But I also acknowledge that he probably got enough help from me this time that it's my fault.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's plenty of blame to go around there.
Yeah, you know, I think most of it lies with me. I was the one playing softball with him the entire game. After that, we played a game that you picked up called A Battle Through History, a Sabaton game.
A Sabaton game.
We found out what Sabaton was.
Yeah, apparently they're a metal band.
They're a metal band who I had never heard of. I'm sorry. But they apparently have their own board game that is all about recruiting and defeating armies through four eras of history, deck building with them, and then continuing to fight more historical army units. So if you've ever wanted a game where you can recruit some Zulu warriors to somehow take out a World War II era fighter plane, this is the game for you.
Yeah, that was the funnest part for me was like, yeah, I'm gonna attack this,
yeah,
you know, B-52 with my trebuchet.
The ridiculous nature of those matchups and how they still somehow come out on top despite the fact that they're, like, you know, outclassed by 1,000 years.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's a game where there's, like, basically, like, three layers of combat, right? There's, like, long distance, medium distance, and close-up combat. And each card has a certain stat or no stat for those particular ranges. And you're trying to basically, like, you resolve them in that order, like, long, medium, short. And whoever has the greater of the score between all their cards for each one of those ranges then inflicts a number of wounds equal to the difference between the two sides' numbers.
Yeah.
And then, like, that can potentially, like, you know, wipe out their army, or, like, you know, maybe only wipe out one card or only injure one card or whatever. And you play until you've gone through all three of those phases or until one side has no units left. And then any units that you have defeated in combat when you're playing against the board, right? Because you can also play against other players, or you can attack other players. We're playing against each other the entire time, mm-hmm. but you basically have a choice of either fighting against sort of like the AI cards on the board or your opponents,
yeah.
your human opponents. Yeah. Anyway, when you defeat those AI cards, you then kind of flip them over and then bring them into your deck, and that's how you kind of like acquire the cards for the deck that you're building. And you go through that over, for us it was 6 rounds. You can also, anytime you win a battle and you have warriors remaining, you then can also, like, you know, kind of retrieve some number of victory cards if you didn't kind of go overboard on the number of units that you used. And that's just another way to kind of get points. All the cards that you acquire in the game are worth a certain number of points, whether they're like a special hero unit or just a rank and file sort of like, you know, warrior or whatever. Mm-hmm. They're not always warriors. Like, sometimes they're tanks.
Yeah. Yeah. Tanks, planes.
But,
you know.
But it really reminded me of Gwent from the Witcher video game. I know you've said you hadn't played that before, but it uses like a very similar sort of like this line attacks this line, like this line attacks like from here and everything. It's a little more complicated because it's a video game, so they can put in all kinds of things like, you know, like variable effects for the units that this game couldn't go deep enough with.
Yeah.
And like all kinds of other stuff, like, you know, like fog of war type stuff and everything. But it kind of evoked that for me with a little bit more streamlined sort of design. Which I think is, it's a fun design. I don't think that it's necessarily like hugely like impactful in the board game space or like revolutionary or mm-hmm. anything, but I think it works for what it is.
Yeah.
Which is like a relatively midweight, lightweight to midweight sort of like card-based war game.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had a decent enough time playing it. I think it was a little bit hampered by the fact that it was late and we were exhausted, and
yeah,
and it was dragging on a little bit too long, although it started to get faster.
It sped up yeah. But it's got a little, the one thing that I would say, we were playing a 3-player game, I probably wouldn't want to play with more people than that, because you run into that problem where like the 100% of the time that we were playing it, and we figured out that at most 50% of the time that you could play, right, you are playing against the board, not other people,
right,
like
yeah.
in terms of the battles, right? You're fighting the board, not other people. And that, you're detached from that most of the time. You should be detached from that. We weren't, right? Like, when we were playing, I think we were all looking at each other's sort of setup and being like, oh, wait, if you put that guy there, then he'll trigger this thing, which then, yeah. like, negates that guy's thing. And so we were all kind of collaborating in terms of, like, what everybody should be doing to play their best
yeah.
while we were playing that
yeah.
game. But if you were playing this truly competitively, then you wouldn't do that, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't give people advice, in which case you're just going to be sitting there waiting for them to complete their turn. And this is a lot of like just sort of math. Like, it's just kind of like sitting there and figuring out, okay, if I put this guy here, then this effect's going to resolve first, and it's going to, you know, like take this guy out before he can resolve his effect. And this number is more than that number when we combine this and we add in this little token over here. So it's a lot of like sort of like if then and numbers. And that takes a while for certain people to kind of like figure out, because it's a game that you can figure out. You can kind of solve every battle that you're in, as long as you don't pull in some random cards, which is another thing that it does sometimes,
yeah.
but you can avoid it. And so it's a game where you can sort of math your way through the fight. And the problem there is that that can take some time,
yeah.
right? And so you're just sitting there waiting for somebody to do their math problem. That probably is the biggest drawback to this game for me. However, when we played it, I still had fun because, as I've mentioned, we were basically all doing the math
right,
together,
yeah.
right? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. But, you know, like, if that sounds like fun, go check it out. I would take a look. It's a very interesting theme, to say the least. And like we mentioned earlier, the idea of, you know, like, a bunch of people taking a plane down with spears is kind of hilarious.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
Yeah. Then we played the crew. And then we played the next day, Mini Rogue, which we've always talked about. And that was Gen Con. That was Gen Con 2022.
Finny.
In a nutshell. A 1.5-hour nutshell.
Oh.
Yeah. So apologies that we kind of stretched this out over one full episode rather than cutting it up into three, yeah, which we typically do. But this is the only way it's going to happen this year. Sorry. Maybe we'll do better next year.
Maybe.
But I kind of like the way I kind of had more fun this year.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice to just sort of do your thing and, you know, sort of jot down what you want to say about stuff, but then just do it after you're done enjoying yourself.
Yeah. I recognize that there's a lot of, you know, media outlets out there that are doing real-time coverage of Gen Con, and that's very valuable, I'm sure, to a lot of people out there, but that's just not who we are.
Right.
You know, like, we go to Gen Con to have fun. We do this podcast because we enjoy doing it. We enjoy talking about games together, and it just gives us some structure for how to do that, you know, and make it feel like, I don't know, like there's some meaning to it or some reason to do it, basically. And that's what this podcast really is. So we've always said, like, it's here to help people and inform people about purchases, especially people that maybe don't have a lot of time to play their games and they're only going to have like some early and first impressions. Right. That's what this podcast has kind of been framed as. But it's really always just been about Jason and I having an excuse to talk about games together and play games together. So that will probably continue to be the case as long as we do it. And we will continue to do that even if we're never recording in the future again. So,
absolutely.
We have no plans to quit at the moment. So. I think that we have a few more games we haven't even talked about because we both bought some games that we didn't actually have a chance to play. So we will probably check those out eventually and hopefully be able to report back on some of those things and maybe actually do some full reviews on them. And I think we even alluded to one or two games that we talked about today that we maybe want to do a deeper dive on in the future and do full reviews on the podcast.
Yeah.
Usually when we get a chance to just play a game once at Gen Con or like maybe even like not a full game like we did with Twilight Imperium, Jason and I usually attempt to either play it when we're face-to-face again next time or to play online through Tabletop Simulator or some other, you know, like online way of playing the video games or the video games, the board games, so that we can do a more complete, you know, like holistic take on the game. So that's what we'll be doing in the coming weeks and months for some of the games that we only got to touch a little bit, you know, as well as any other games that come up that we happen to play. So you'll have that to look forward to in the coming weeks. Any other thoughts on Gen Con 2022, Jason?
No.
What did you think of the crowd? They uncapped attendance, and so they just released a media release saying that they got to 50,000 people this year. Which I believe is like 20,000 more than last year, but still 20,000 fewer than 2019. So we were kind of like right in between the low point of last year and the high point of 2019.
I mean, it was noticeably more crowded than last year.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's fine. It's kind of how that was before, like, all the pandemic stuff happened. Like, it was always fairly crowded. I do miss the fact that, you know, we were able to move around with much more ease last year.
Yeah. It was, I mean, we were like salmon fighting upstream this year.
Right.
Whereas last year, we just, like, kind of had the whole pond to ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
But that made a difference. It was kind of nice, though, to see just the liveliness of the show this year compared to last year. I think last year was fun because we it felt like we had the whole place to ourselves, but it also was a little bit sad, you know, like, because it just wasn't as big of a spectacle as it typically was. You know, it felt like a wounded animal instead of, you know, a healthy one. And this year it felt a lot healthier.
Yeah.
Because of how crowded it was, because of how much cosplay there was on Saturday, you know, because of how many like pickup games we saw going in the convention halls and in the hotels surrounding the convention hall and everything. Whereas last year we just hid in our room anytime we weren't, you know, out doing an event. So, you know, we came out of hiding. We left the mask on, but we came out of hiding, and it felt more like actual Gen Con this year, which I think I appreciated.
Yeah.
But like you said, I did miss kind of having some breathing room from last year.
Well, and for the love of God, people, don't stop in the middle of the traffic.
Yes, for real. What do you think is happening behind you?
You're holding up the works.
Yes. Step off to the side. Find a spot. Jeez.
My number one piece of advice.
Yeah, that's a big pet peeve, but I feel like, you know, any reasonable person that goes to Gen Con probably has that exact pet peeve.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Okay, well, that was Gen Con 2022. Thank you for listening, and we will be back in probably 2 or 3 weeks with a deeper dive on one of those games, or maybe we'll start talking about one of the other games that we picked up, because I've got Burgle Brothers 2 that I'd love to get to. You've got my father's work, along with several other things, and I'm excited to try those games them out and talk about them. So, yeah, that'll be on the list within the next couple of months. So, all right, thanks for listening, everybody.
Later.
We'll see you in 2 or 3 weeks. Bye.